Welcome to the Sober Gay Sunday podcast, a podcast about being gay and sober and not just on Sundays. In this podcast, we'll explore the ins and outs of being queer and sober in a world where drinking and using is woven into the fabric of our culture. This season, we'll be hearing the stories of addiction and recovery from sober gays from all over the world. Every story of recovery is unique in its own way, and every story deserves to be heard. So let's go. In this episode, we welcome Omar. Omar is a proud first-generation college graduate from San Francisco State University, an academic journey made possible through working the steps of Crystal Meth Anonymous. Omar has been in the room since 2015 with varying lengths of sobriety and is currently in his prosperous era. He gives back through service to his fellowship as the events coordinator with the goal of making social events for recovery accessible and affordable for all. Please welcome Omar.
Hey, Omar, welcome to the pod.
Hey there, good morning. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely, absolutely. So why don't we start off by you telling us your name, your preferred pronouns, and just a little bit about yourself.
So my name is Omar Morales. My preferred pronouns are he, him. And I'm a contemporary gay man of the modern age living in Chicago, Illinois. I'm from Dallas, Texas, actually. And I moved here. This is actually my second time living in Chicago, which is where I got sober. So which is why I kind of moved back here, was the nostalgia for that. And the sober family I have here. But I've also spent some time in San Francisco, and I think I mentioned I'm from Dallas, so I was raised there, so I have spent some time there as well.
Very nice. Is your family still in Dallas?
Yeah, they're all still there. Biological. I would say all my chosen family is here in Chicago.
Very nice, very nice. So why don't you start us off by telling us about your first drinking or using experience, and then just kind of take us through your story up until where you are now.
Sure. Okay. When I was in high school, I was very academically gifted, and this was my parents' wildest dream come true. And they wanted to make sure that I achieved the dream that they had for me, which eventually did become my dream too. But it was, you know, they kind of like forced me to, in a way, but it was more of just like encouragement, I guess I should say. And it worked because, well, I'll get to that part later, but, anyway, my parents were very big on me going to school and doing well in school. And the more and more that I did, that I maintained my good grades, I was always getting into like different programs and like getting all kinds of accolades. They had a kind of hands-off approach, because they noticed that when they would try to tell me what to do, that I would get really upset and then I would like throw fits, and they just did not want their first generation college dream to evaporate or to disintegrate. So the hands-off approach is what they did. And so as long as I made good grades, they would not question me. I could do whatever I wanted, but it really depended on grades. So this is a theme that kind of like goes on through to the present day, where if I allow myself certain things, if I achieve a certain, you know, goal, or if I maintain a certain level of this or that, and that's been a great thing for me, but it's also been really bad. And how it was bad for me at that time was because I did so well in high school that I was able to graduate a year early, except I did not graduate a year early. I had one of those ridiculous notions that I wanted to graduate from my class, even though I hated all my classmates. I didn't want to leave school early because it just meant that I would have to face like the reality of coming out. And so what ended up happening was, I took one class my senior year. And so I had all this time during the day, Monday through Friday, I have things to do. And so when Friday would roll around, after being bored, only taking one class, every day, there was this guy who looked pretty much like me, and he was the opposite of me. He had been held over like so many times, and he had a fake ID. So I think I did like one of his homework assignments or something. Like I did something to where he gave me his ID. Mm-hmm. And I used that to go to the bathhouse, because I had heard about this place called a men's spa. And you know what young gay guy doesn't want, like, nice skin?
Right.
That was not what that's about. It was like all those ads that you would see in the rags, you know, the gay rags. You would see the, you know, a bunch of guys like hanging out, hanging 10 by like some like really beautiful like cascade of waterfalls, which no bathhouse that I've ever been to has those cascade of waterfalls.
False advertising.
But that was the draw. That was the draw for me. I wanted to just see what that was about. And so, to my huge and lifelong misfortune, I went to the bathhouse at 16 with a fake ID. And the very first person that I met in the locker room was a drug dealer. And I met him because when I walked in, I mean, I didn't know what to do. I thought you. I don't know what I was thinking, but they were like, "Yeah, just you know, go over here to this." Over here to the right, there's a room in there, there's lockers. And I had this really like bad experience being bullied. I'm in gym class as a kid. So when I heard locker room, like I am automatically like, I'm like, oh my God, my worst fear is here too. And I just had that look on me. And so this guy, I guess he just, you know, he just knew to approach me. And I don't know if he was being friendly or just, you know, I'm not gonna go as far as to say as I think he was just being friendly, but it just, like I said, to my misfortune, he was a drug dealer. And so that's where it all started. I learned everything there is to know, or everything that most of us know about crystal meth, that takes some of us, you know, months or years to learn. I learned it all in the span of like 3 weeks, because this was like right as summer was starting. So, I had like a really, a lot of time and no supervision. Like I had a lot of leeway and I abused that. I went to the bathhouse, man. Like I went like every day for 2 weeks because this guy who was he wasn't like, I remember him being like a very like he had this very debonair look to him. And I'm sure if I saw him now at that, you know, if I saw him how he was then now, I probably think differently. But as a young gay guy, you think like, you know, an athletically built, attractive man, older man, you know, is very tantalizing. At least it was for me back then. And this guy, he was not only that, but super friendly. So in that moment, I just, you know, I went along with it. And this person like really took me under his wing. And I don't know if that's the right term I want to use for that, but like I was basically like, I guess co-opted is the better word. And I became like this guy's, I became like his drug runner at the bathhouse. I would like, we would have all this fun, like we'd have all this sex and do all these drugs, but like I was running drugs for some guy in a bathhouse before I was even 18. And when graduation came up, I knew that that was my, you know, I was like, okay, that was fun, you know, gotta like go to I had a full year, a full ride to a very conservative university in Dallas. And I thought that I needed to, you know, get ready for that. And so I couldn't do the bathhouse anymore. I was like, oh, that was fun. Okay, now let's focus on my studies. And I actually ended up because of that experience at the bathhouse at a very young age, I ended up dropping out of my first year. I'm sorry, not dropping out, being expelled due to academic probation in my first year. And this was like the big dream that my parents had, and it just came crashing and burning down. And they were just so, they could not understand like what it was. And so their what they thought they were needed to do was to give me because you know, we grew up I grew up poor, grew up, like a lower middle class family, and my parents were immigrants from Mexico. So there was not a lot of fortune or wealth in our family, but their solution to that problem that I had at the university the first year that I went was to give me lots of money, or any money that they could scrounge up so that I wouldn't have to work, which we know that's like the perfect formula for, you know, basically enabling. And and it just carried on. Like it just kept going because I didn't have to report to anybody because I lived on campus. I didn't have anyone to report to. I had all the resources that I needed you know, a fledgling addiction. And I kept it going and going and going. And then as I was starting to realize that things were quickly unraveling, I remember going to the doctor and because I had like an I had set, I think I had syphilis by five times by the time I was 20. It was like not good. And I went to the doctor and I was like, hey doctor, like thanks for the the three series of double injections in my in my ass cheeks. I had this.
Oh, I
Yeah,
know.
I know, right? I mean, it's so awful. And like I remember I cried. I cried. I don't know what your response was, but I remember it, the first one was like, okay. And then he there was like a I had to do three more series of that. And I just remember crying on the second round because I was still sore from that very first time and it was like so bad. But so at the doctor, this and this is the moment that's probably like the most I mean, I know going to the bathhouse at a young age and developing an addiction before you're 18 is a pretty fucked up moment. But this is the moment where I knew that I was in that things were like I did not, I was clueless as to what to do because I always thought like, oh, I could just ask for help. I could just do this or there's a solution somewhere. And I remember going to the doctor and telling him like, hey, I have this problem. Can you give me a prescription for this? And he looked me in the eyes and he goes, there is nothing I can prescribe you for this. Like you have to go to AA. You need to go to NA. And I didn't know what that was. Like, I didn't understand. And I remember I was coming down at that time, and that poor doctor, who was also he was gay. I unleashed on him because I was furious. I thought that he was keeping the medication from me. I thought that he wanted, like, I had all these delusions because it was coming down, and I lashed out so hard, and I actually got banned from that clinic. Because I was like, I thought he was keeping it from me. I'm like, give me this remedy because you're a doctor there. And I've been working at a restaurant at that time, or prior to. And I remember this lesbian who had she had like a heroin addiction, and she went away for like a month, and she came back, and she was talking about how she was doing better, and they gave her this medication, and that's what planted the seed about the medication. Because I'm like, if my lesbian's doing it, then I'm gonna get that same pill she's got. So anyway, that's where my struggle started because I didn't have that medication and I didn't know what to do. And when I would go to when I would go to some meetings that the person who told me I couldn't go back to the clinic was also a gay guy. Who had suggested he handed me a pamphlet and he's like, just go to one of these things and see what it's like. I didn't have a really good experience because I was one this was in Dallas, Texas, and everybody that I encountered and pretty much all the meetings that I went to were older. They were much older, overwhelmingly Caucasian. So for me coming from a lower middle class neighborhood, inner city urban neighborhood, suddenly being thrust into a situation where I'm around a bunch of older gay white men who have no kind of like at that time, I think people are much better now, but at that time I had no like very little cultural competency to me. And that was something that I always looked for because I need to be able to relate to people and I don't speak white. And at that time I didn't speak like what I call uppity white gay. And which I'm kind of fluent in now because I've had to learn, but at that time it was just so hard for me to be in that space because there was nobody who looked like me. There was nobody around my age, nobody I could relate to, and the only guys that were showing me any kind of remote like attention didn't necessarily weren't necessarily talking to me because they wanted to help me. So I'll just put it like that. And so I just left a re really bad taste in my mouth. But what ended up happening, and this is kind of like a where things start to go better, is that I had spent many years in Dallas using. I had run across somebody who I'd used it several times, and he disappeared one day. And when he disappeared, he was kind of like my closest using friend. I use the word friend, air quotes. But he disappeared, and I was just, I didn't have anything going on in Dallas. So I moved to Chicago, and I thought he had died. Like, I honestly, like, I thought he had died because I couldn't reach him. Nobody knew where he was. And then I pulled a geographical, and one day out of the blue, I get a text message, and it's from this guy, and he's sending me a link, just a straight up link. And it was to crystalmeth.org. And he goes, hey, Omar, I don't know what you're doing, where you are, but I just wanted to let you know that I haven't used drugs in, I think it was like 2 years at that point. And this is how I did it. And I remembered that experience of going to the rooms. And then just like I swatted it away so fast. I'm like, I remember thinking so many things of why not to go, right? We all come up with every excuse like immediately why it's not for us, why we can't go because we don't have a problem, you know, it's at the wrong times, like all these things. And so, but when I was out using, just a lot in those days, almost every week, this person would it's funny because he would message me. It seemed to me like he would message me right in the middle of when I was using, like, would totally kill my buzz,
Yeah.
so to speak. And I'd get that text message, like, as I'm, like, probably, like, well, you know, well, as I'm doing certain things. And it was always at the worst time. And one day, I just remember I clicked on the link, and it said something about, like, a meeting that was probably, like, a block away. And at that point, like, I had been homeless, like, you know. There's so many things that happened that we all experienced. I don't think I need to go into the using log because it's the same, but it devolved into me being homeless and moving out of my car, which was a brand new car, but I'm still homeless. I think somehow I think that's better, right? At least my car was within 2 years old. That if you're living out of a car that's new, then it's not as bad.
Right.
It was just
The justifications,
as
absolutely.
bad. This keeps going. I mean, I could tell you how like I was the most bougie homeless person, but we all know that's not true. So this link to this meeting that was super close by, close to the place where the guys who was letting me stay with him, it was at a church, and that was like automatically I'm like, oh my God, no, not again, not like. And it was in a basement, so I'm thinking like, not the basement, not the fluorescent lights, not the like shitty tables and chairs and that shitty coffee, like not again.
Yeah.
But I drove my unhappy ass over there, and I sat in that parking lot. This was like a Saturday, 6 o'clock in the evening meeting, and I sat in that parking lot for 4 weeks in a row because I could not go inside. The first week, it was because you know, I had been crying. I was crying my eyes out because I was having to do this, and like I didn't know what was going on. It was like turmoil. And I said, "Oh, my eyes are too red. They're gonna know that I'm like. They're gonna know I'm unhappy. They're gonna know. They're gonna see me." So you know, a week rolls around. I use throughout that whole week. Like I repeat this process 4 times, but every week it's something different. It's like, well, my eyes are red. The next week, it's like my skin looks bad, or I'm dressed in tatters, and I'm late. And so then finally, ironically, April 20th rolls around, and I go like I'm in the worst. I'm in like even worse shape than I was all those 4 weeks combined. My eyes were red. My skin was horrible. I was dressed in tatters, and I was late. But I couldn't do it anymore. So I walked in there like with the accumulation of all those reasons why I couldn't go those first few weeks. And that's where my life changed because that was the day that I decided to give this to open my heart and open my mind because I finally saw some younger people. I finally saw people that were like my age, around my age. There were some guys who kind of like looked the way that I wished I looked because body issue, being gay, you have all kinds of issues with your appearance. And like these guys look like they actually are fun. They look healthy. They look awake. I like kind of like what some of them are wearing. And I'm like, I'm gonna stick around. And so at that very first meeting, I remember asking this guy, like that was really cute to be my sponsor. Yeah, I know I made all these cardinal errors, but it actually ended up being one of the best decisions that I made because even though you should never pick somebody because they look good, picking the person that looked good worked out for me because while he was very attractive, he knew that and he had such a he did he had such a great program and was so had so much reverence and respect for a program that had given him all these things in his in the 2 years I think of time he was sober that he did not tolerate that like. You know, the like the trivial things that we all kind of like think about that are aesthetic based or not or materialistic. And he's like, listen, like I'm pretty sure I know why you chose me as your sponsor, but I'm gonna tell you right now, If you want me to sponsor you, you can't do drugs, you can't drink, you can't smoke pot, you have to do this, you have to do that. And I remember, like, I cannot believe that somebody was trying to tell me what to do, because remember,
Yep.
nobody would tell me what to do because I got to do anything that I wanted and all my life. And he set me straight. I mean, I remember going to like those like 8 o'clock in the morning AA meetings, which I was so furious because I've never had a drinking problem. Like, that's never been, it's not part of my story. And unfortunately, like, I could drink, but it was like the drinking and cocaine or something, like the bridge. So the gateway had a gateway. So it was like drinking was never, but as soon as I drank, I may have done like marijuana and maybe that would have gotten me there. Maybe the cocaine, but drinking was never actually the problem. So I didn't connect with AA. I thought that I didn't need to be there.
Yeah.
But I got this like really firm, classic, like big book thumper upbringing. And I'm so grateful for that because it gave me this foundation that I would use to build a very, what I consider now to be like a really successful like sobriety career. And I remember one of the most important things that I've carried over from that is that I remember my sponsor telling me, he's like, look, this space is not for sleeping around. Like, this is not somewhere where you're going to find your partner. This is not somewhere where you should date. I remember thinking, like, this is crazy, like, this is why I'm here, partially, you know, right? Like, in the back of your mind, you're like, I'm kind of here, I'm probably might fuck somebody, because I do, like, I do have, like, I'm pretty sex positive, like, I had, like, a really, I would say, healthy and active, like, sex life, but I've never, in 8 years, I've never, not once, slept with anybody in the rooms, and, like, I'm super proud of that, because I owe that to, like, that super rigid,
yeah,
super rigid, very handsome first sponsor that I had. I talk about that all the time, and people think I don't know if that this part of my story resonates very much with a lot of people in recovery, because from what I observe, people are having sex with each other all the time, but yeah, they're also having a lot of those problems that come with that. So I'm always reminded, I'm frequently reminded of how that wisdom is still there and not sleeping with people in the rooms. And so I'm super grateful for that. I don't think I'd have the recovery that I would have if I had a sponsor, that very first sponsor, who was like lenient in any of those categories, because that's what I needed. You know, I needed a severe attitude adjustment. And so I wish I could tell you that that everything was sunshine and rainbows after that. I did end up achieving up to, like, I think it was at 3.5 years of recovery. And I want to tell you that it just kept going, you know, that it was like this story, but that's not the case. Like, I remember at 3.5 years, like, I was so let me just talk about the solution. So I had a sponsor who helped me work the steps. I had all my friends were in recovery. I was active in the fellowship. We had a lot of fun social activities, which I really used as like the reason to go back. And that's super important. So I'm going to tell you why in a little bit. But all these things, all these great things were happening. Like, I suddenly had friends. People wanted to hang out with me. Like, I was going to the gym. Like, my self-esteem was improving. My confidence, my physical appearance was improving. And then I just got complacent. I just got really, like, I guess it's true. You know what they say? Like, if you come to if you're not mad at anybody, don't come to enough meetings. And that's true. Like, I went to meetings all the time and constantly, and recovery was the center of my world, and I didn't really do much else in recovery. So just as quickly as I built all that up, it was too much. Like, I had gotten into like so many arguments by that 3.5 years, because, you know, you just do. I'm just like, because, you know, there's always going to be, you know, there's a lot of obsessive controlling people in the rooms, and that's not to put anybody off or say like you shouldn't go to recovery. I'm gonna go as far as to say, as those people are necessary, because through those experiences, those tough experiences of dealing with those people, I have a thicker skin, I have better people skills, I know how to manage my relationships with people with those tendencies now, whereas I probably would have never developed them. And I was only able to do that because, you know, I had people in the rooms, like my sponsors and my friends, to help me figure that out. Like, hey, why is this person like constantly like telling people like getting on to people for being late. Like, what the fuck is his problem? Like, why does he care? And it just, these were like the kinds of things that I would have, the conversations that I would have. But, and while I never got the answer right away that I wanted, it was just like a slow burn of wisdom that was passed on to me as to why we do the readings every time and why we should be on time and why you shouldn't be on your phone and why you shouldn't, like, all these things. And so while I highly dislike obsessive controlling people in the rooms, they're kind of necessary in a way, like I said. And so anyway, but at that time I didn't see that. Okay, so that wisdom has come in the present day. But I let all those an accumulation of things that would just were that were bothering me to push me out of the rooms. And I want to talk about this one theme a little bit, because it actually is probably the theme that I should spend the most time on, but I've moved past this. It wasn't after it was after 3.5 years, after I had relapsed, where and relapsed, when I went out, I was out for a few years. And in that time, I was still going to meetings. And this was in San Francisco. I had moved. And that was kind of part of the problem, because I was expecting my recovery experience from Chicago to translate to San Francisco. And that was not the case. Oh my gosh, that was not the case. And I was struggling with recovery myself. I was struggling with having moved and, like, getting to know people. And then I was struggling with not getting traction in the rooms. And so all this, like, was the perfect storm for me. I'm going out and not really, like, committing to the rooms there in San Francisco. And then I ended up using with somebody who was in the rooms. And I remember him. We did all the things. We hung out quite a bit, actually. And there was a lot of, like, things that I regret doing, especially when it comes to, like, we live in the age of the content creation, of the influencers, of selfies. Like, that is our everyone. Like, that's what our instinct is to do nowadays. Like, it's like, if you're not doing that, then you're not succeeding in life. Because nowadays, like, being on social media, and, like, that is, in some way, that is how, it's just a bend of future of the future and technology. And how this worked in with how this what this has to do with using is that I was never, like, a camera person. I was never a photo person. And then all of a sudden, because of the advent of Zoom and better phone technologies, like, this guy, he, like, got me into doing, like, making videos and taking photos and getting on Zoom and doing all these things that I was always, like, I felt like I was really good about not doing, or staying away from, because when you see those pictures of people, you're like, ooh, and I just never wanted that to be me. But all of a sudden, like, here I am, and that's me. Like, I'm being photographed, and I'm photographing people. Like, we're making videos and all these things. And I went on this, like, major bender with this person. And my life fell apart again in San Francisco, which is not a good place to be, like, to be experiencing economic, like, insecurity.
Oh, I'm sorry.
And I'm pretty sure, right here, you said you're in Boston.
Yeah.
I'm pretty sure that's the case there too, right? Like, Boston's one of these places, like, high, it's a high cost of living.
Sorry, yeah, pretty
And
reckless.
I was experiencing that. And so I went into the rooms, and I'm like, okay, Omar, we're gonna do this. We're gonna get up in these rooms here in this wretched city. And even though you haven't had the same recovery experience, you're gonna try. And I remember trying and trying. And then one day, this person that I had used with showed up to a meeting. It was a birthday night. And I'm sitting there, I'm just thinking about this. I'm like, how uncomfortable it is to see somebody, right, that you have a using history with, or an addiction history with. And the next thing I know, I hear his name, and he's collecting, like, a 3 or 4 year chip, and everybody in the room starts clapping for him. And I just lose my mind, because I cannot believe that that was happening. I'd never been in that situation where somebody that I knew was collecting a dirty chip. And I went mad, because I went to the few friends that I had, and I'm like, hey, I have something to tell you. I can't tell you who it is, but let me just tell you about the situation. And I explained it, and they're like, well, how do you know it really happened? Like, were you really there? Maybe you were just. And I'm like, no, girl, I have the receipts. Like, do you want to see? Because this isn't right. Like, why do I have to come here and do this and be honest and all these things? And we're giving chips to somebody that I used with, like, I think it was like a month before. Maybe it wouldn't have been as problematic, but one of the people that I was friends with was Hispanic. And so I'm just like, thinking about it now, it really did fuck with me. And I went mad, like I said. Like I tried to go, I tried to do the thing that I knew how to do best, which was like approach people in a diplomatic way and say, hey, I'm not really that upset. I just want to know what you think we should do or what I should do. And the answer that I always got, and to this day, when I bring it up with anybody, even now, when I supposedly have dealt with this issue, is that is like basically like loosely translated, like, well, 1 hour that they're in here is 1 hour that they're not out there. So leave them alone. And I couldn't cope with that. Like I've had such a struggle with that. And it's been a long road of dealing with that, because it's like this. Oh, and this whole pro while this was happening, I was also the reason I moved to California was because I transferred to university, and I was working on a degree. Like I was really lucky that I was finally able to like go back to school. And through those 3 years of cling time that I had, I'd gotten an associate's. I was into my third year. I was well on my way to completing achieving that dream. And this was the thing in San Francisco that unraveled that for me. Like I started to struggle. Like as I got back to a point where I was making straight A's. Like for I think this I was in my third year. I had a 4.0 for 3 years, and then I knew that I was in trouble because this issue. Like all of a sudden I was getting B's. I got a C, and I'm like, oh my God, this is happening. I don't know what to do. I'm about to get expelled again. It took a lot of it took a lot of time and another geographical to deal with that. And I was able to one leave that physical space and that person and this concept that I was really upset about. And what I did was when I decided to leave San Francisco, it was for a job. I'd graduated by this point. And I had gotten a job, like a reason to move, right? Is to because you have a job, you have something to go to, you're not running from something. And so what I did was I went on a I drove all the way from San Francisco to Chicago with a stop in Dallas. And on that drive, I just remember telling myself, I'm like, okay, Omar, you need to process this. Like you cannot carry this over. It cannot be this thing that drives you away, because it just, I mean, I don't know, my education kind of worked against me, because it's like a logic thing, right? Like there's this thing like, how can we talk about honesty, accountability, and then not apply that when it matters most? And this is the message that I have about this particular thing, is that you will not solve that problem. There will always be people in the rooms who are taking dirty chips, just like there's people who are obsessive and controlling.
Yeah, exactly.
And you have to just like with the obsessive and controlling people who will never go away, unfortunately, the people who collect dirty chips, who you might have used with, who you might hear collect, and really like distort your like really fuck with your mind, you have to use that to your advantage, not let it drag you down. And so how I use that is just as an example of what not to do. And as long as I'm not lying about my sobriety time, as long as I'm not lying about anything that has to do with recovery or anything in my life for that matter, like I'm gonna be okay. And so it took a lot of like therapy and stuff. And so anyway, that's the message I have on that. I it was such a big struggle, but thankfully, like on that long drive, I made a set of agreements with myself. I committed to the program, and I said, you know what? When I land back in Chicago, luckily I still had like a good portion of my sober family here. A few of them had left us. A few of them have, transitioned to a different way of life here. But I would say like a good 70% were still around. And so I got to work when I got here to Chicago. I had coffee or lunch with everybody that I had that was still in my Facebook, who I hadn't like purged on some like bender. I reached out to people as possible. I'm like, hey, can we go to coffee? Can we go to lunch? Like, I'm here. I really need this to happen again. And I'm so lucky that that long drive and the agreements that I made with myself, the that long conversation, like really, really helped me, because I was able to so lightning struck twice, like here in Chicago. That's the best way to put it. I didn't know what was going to happen. I did have the experience with some friends that were still in the rooms who had just changed. Like, you know, you can't always be friends with everybody. Like, for some people are like seasonal kind of friends. I'm a lifelong kind of friend. Like, I'm the kind of friend that, like, if we meet and we vibe, like, I'm gonna roll with you until the wheels fall off. Like, I'm committed to relationships with my friends like that. But not everybody's that way. And there are some people that I notice, they're like, oh, hey, you're back. Nice to see you. You know, see you at a meeting. And I'm like, okay, we used to spend the night at my house. Like, we went trips together. Like, we shared a bathroom. Like, come on. And so anyway, I had a really good experience coming back to Chicago, and I'm lucky. I'm so lucky because since I've been back, like, I've experienced like my okay. So I'll tell you the things that like I, that I've done. So I go to a meeting, at least one meeting every day. Typically, I go to more than one a day. I think I go to like maybe 8 to 10 meetings a week, and that's because I work from home. So I throw on a Zoom meeting at noon. Shout out to Serenity at noon in Dallas, which has been such a lifeline for me during the day when I'm having like a meltdown at work. I can just jump on Zoom and tell everybody like what's going on. And really, like, what's the beauty of that too, and why I'm so thankful to Serenity at noon in Dallas, is that when there's something going on in the fellowship here, I can just jump on that meeting and I can like totally unload without like, you know, sometimes you don't want to, like, there's anonymity, there's all these like things that you don't want to, like, faux pas, or, you know, you don't want to be problematic or increase it, add to your problems by dragging somebody, like, in, you know, in a share. But doing it in a meeting, in a fellowship from somewhere else, frees you from all of that. So it's so helpful to me to do Serenity at noon. And then I go to a meeting every night, or in the morning, on the weekends here in Chicago. I'm just I'm the chair for the or I'm the co-chair for the social events committee, which is going back to what I was saying when I first got sober, like all those fun things that I got to do when I was suddenly getting invited to things, and suddenly like included in these plans. Like, that really was what made onboarding into the program really stick for me. And so at the heart of everything that I do in recovery, my thing that drives me, what keeps me coming back, what makes me participate and be of service, is that, like, I want as many people, I want everybody to have access to the fun things that we get to do. And I've had the experience where some fellowships, like, they're really awesome, like they have a really strong social component. And others that have like a not so the emphasis is not on social events. But it's my belief that that should be the case. And so that's what drives me. Like, either I want to, if there's a strong social component happening already, like, I want to be involved. If there isn't one, like, let me help, like, lift that up. And that is how I get back to the rooms. That is how I get back to my fellows. And that is how I keep myself in check, because the moment that I stop being active in, I mean, meetings are great. Like, that meetings are the lifeblood, but the social events are what keep me here. You know, it's like, it's what animates the fun side of things and lets everybody like relate. Lets me connect with people that I wouldn't connect with in meetings, because, you know, just by virtue of not being like an open forum. And anyway, that's just what I'm all about these days. I'm all about creating events that are fun, that are free mostly. And for those events that are not free, I really push really hard for there to be like, this last month, we pushed through we have a little budget, you know, for those fellows who are struggling or who need a little extra help or who want to attend but can't. Like, we make sure that anybody that wants to go to an event, no matter how much it costs, can go. And at the end of the day, that is for me, like, the goal in recovery is to like keep that going. And it's funny, because I'm not thinking about myself when I do that. It's like, I just remember being super, super broke and coming to these rooms and people taking me to dinner, people taking me to fellowship, not dinner, fellowship, inviting me to the movies, and like never having to ask, you know, like this in this weird way. Like, it was almost, I wouldn't say I was being profiled. It was more of like, you know, we all know what somebody who's who's on, you know, who's struggling, what looks like and what they sound like and what they say and what their concerns are. And that's just what I look out for. That's why I go back to the rooms. Like, I'm looking for the people who need help the most. And really, And that's not something that I was doing before because I was going to all the events. I was benefiting from them, but I wasn't, I was not giving, like I did not, with service, I did not, like in my first round of recovery, when I had those 3.5 years, I actually avoided service. That's because somebody invited me to a committee meeting once that, oh, okay. So this is important because it has to do with service and you shouldn't be afraid of service. You should do service. No matter what you see or what you hear at one of your first service experiences. And for 3 or 4 years, I never did service because within the first month of being in the rooms, somebody invited me to join a committee for the regional conference or something. You know, I didn't know anything. I didn't know what that was, but I was like, sure, thanks for inviting me. Like, oh, I was in the business of going to things. And within the first 5 minutes, the person who invited me to go, got into like a shouting match. Like it was the most, it was not a good look for anybody who was there. It was just like, you know, they were going at it and I'm like, what is this? So I never went to service. So I never did anything service because I thought that that's what was always going to happen, but that's not the case. That does happen. Like, let's be real. Like there is conflict, but again, you use those experiences to develop because those people are fighting because there's a development issue, which we all experience due to our addiction. And they're just trying their best to like find a way to deal with it. And you should too. Or I should too. Or that's what I took from that experience. It's like, you know, I probably could learn from this. I'm not going to do service, but I understand now that like, and so then this is, and so fast forward to now, like I still see those things, you know, I still see like people fighting, like bickering, but I these days, because of the program and where I'm at in life, like my vibe is like I'm such a peaceful person that if that is going to happen in an intergroup meeting, in a committee meeting or something or another, like it's my goal and it's my purpose, from that first experience all years ago, to neutralize that. And how I do that is, you know, I don't participate in that. Like I make sure that there's some kind of way out that everybody can agree on, and if not, like break the shit up, you know, like end the meeting, restart it again. I feel like it took me, I mean, even though I had 3 years before, 3.5 years of clean time, I'm learning a lot more now. Like I have a lot more wisdom when it comes to the relationship aspects and like how to deal with like things that are problematic. Because if I look back at that first experience, when I came into the rooms, I had it pretty easy. I was like, I think I was 29 or 30. You know, everybody gravitates towards, you know, the fresh young face in the rooms. And I had that going for me, like I did, you know. And there was a lot of things that I didn't get to learn because all that acceptance was handed to me right at the beginning. And so I didn't have to struggle or work hard to be included, to be invited. And I was just there for the fun stuff. It was like this really fucked up way of being in the rooms, even though it worked for me. I learned now that you just can't do that. And plus, like I'm older too, so that wasn't gonna happen again. And so now I actually have to work hard at being liked. It's not just gonna like happen automatically.
So annoying.
I know, right? Like, damn it. So until the secret, until the fountain of youth is discovered, I'm going to continue to to come to meetings and work the steps, be good to my fellows, and try to put together fun events to complement like this sometimes rigid, sometimes perplexing, sometimes contradicting, sometimes like a paradoxical program. But I don't give up on it because it's how I, the rooms are how I got at home, got off the streets. The rooms are how I, now I'm working. I have 2 degrees, thinking about going back to school for a third. Like that's from the rooms right there. Like there's no way I would have been able to be in this position, have achieved that academic dream for my parents and the one that ended up becoming my dream too. And so there's that, there, you know, I talked about economic insecurity. I remember, man, I was so broke. I was so poor. My credits were so terrible. Like it was just things were not good. And like these days, like because of the rooms and like the progress that I've made, like I'm not there anymore. Like I'm on the opposite side of that. Like I have a lot of security that comes from that just comes from the work that I've put into financial amends and just like fixing that part of my life, the wreckage. And that drives that also keeps me like in check because I always know like you're always just a couple of you're always an eviction away from your credit score tanking, and then a lot of things that unfortunately that you have to rely on through because of the fucking capitalist society we live on or live in, a lot of those things kind of dissolve. They're further out of your reach when you start to fuck up and you become careless with your finances, which is all these things are tied together for me. Like with using like it all just, I mean, everything just goes away or declines. And so I'm not that person anymore. Things are so much better. And I have the rooms to thank for that. And I try to think about this thing that I did a few years ago where I experimented with what this so-called quote unquote California sober, which is not a thing because I lived in California and I ran that experiment and research, and the results are that it's not a thing.
Pretty slow for
It's
sure.
not. It just it's it, I mean I'm not gonna go as I mean I'm not this is just I'm speaking on for myself, but it did not work. And I trust me, like I tried it every single way, and I tried to dress it up as I think what are they doing now, like I started doing like psilocybin therapy. I dressed it up as all these things. I went to all these great lengths to like have a doctor give me a prescription for something that I could substitute for crystal meth. And I was never fully happy. I had like some, did I have fun? Sure, here and there. Was it always terrible? No. But did it end in ruin eventually? Yes. Was I unhappy in the end eventually? Miserable. And was it a mistake to do that? It was not a mistake to do that because I needed to experience it, but it would have been a mistake had I kept repeating it or trying to like make it happen. I think that's what I got for you. Like I said, it's been this weird journey, but I'm back and better than ever in recovery. And I didn't think it would ever happen. Like I remember thinking like I fucking hate the rooms. Because of all those paradoxes, I'm like, this is all just a, and it is. There are paradoxes, there are inconsistencies, but you have what I learned to do was to put them on the shelf because there are things to gain from being in the rooms. And just like how you suffer through obsessive controlling people, just how you suffer through people who take dirty chips that you may have used with, whose photos you have still on your phone or things like that. You have to put those on the shelf because what's behind that, to the side of it, beyond it, is far greater. And you'll get those things sooner when you stop obsessing about all these things that, are your reasons for not being there. So that's what I got for you. That's, I
Great.
think, a good place.
It's a great journey. I mean, for sure. It's like you got to concentrate on, it's easy for us to kind of throw our focus on other people around us and everything that they're doing wrong. Then you're just like, yeah, just to, it can ruin the experience of why you're there. So that's definitely a poignant point.
Thank you for tuning in to the Sober Gay Sunday podcast. Please come back next week for the conclusion of this incredible episode. Please take a moment to like, subscribe, share, and comment. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Sober Gay Sunday. Thank you so much for listening, and until next time, stay sober, guys. I'm so sick of small talking. Tell me something, you're jumping at me on my head with your biggest mistakes. I don't want your daily drama. Fill me in on family traumas. Tell me all the medication that you take. Cause life's so short, we're playing so fast.